itself would be a useful addition to any museum. Very calm and quiet, but keen and organised. I wonder if I could persuade her to be my first curator. I'm not going to do it all on my own, am I? Got books to write. Anne, after over 20 years running the museum, is still quite young and clearly committed to the cause, but council-run museums can always come a cropper for reasons outside the museum's control, despite their fame and renown. More changes are in the offing. There is a plan to move the museum out of council hands and into the care of a new body, which will run all the museums in Northumberland. That would bring it under museum people, and perhaps keep the Northumbrian pipes piping for another few hundred years. Around the country, there are lots of town museums where they have old instruments lying around in cabinets, mixed up with other objects. Or house museums, by which I mean an historic old house owned by some worthy from the past, where their collections of clothes, furniture, toys, books, games have been carefully preserved, amongst which you can often come across an old piano, fiddle or flute. But there aren't many devoted entirely to one old ethnic instrument, or many museums of any sort that are three-dimensional, where you can see, touch and hear the objects, one of the purposes of which is to inspire others to listen and play. Or municipal museums that are looking after their inherited treasures so lovingly. Right, I think that covers everything. I can't see myself ever visiting it again, but as I came away, I did feel I should give it a little clap, write 9 out of 10 on its report, say, well done, keep up the good work, chaps. Museums can make you feel good, made virtuous by their virtuousness. Now for something soppy, as we head south again. Morpeth Chantry Bagpipe Museum, Bridge Street, Morpeth, Northumberland, NE 61 1PJ. Telephone 01670 500717. www.morpethnet.co.uk/chantry/BPMUS. Chapter 15. Teddy Bears of Witney. Witney is a small, prosperous country town in Oxfordshire, about 14 miles west of Oxford, famous for centuries for its woolen blankets. The High Street is long, broad and imposing, the sort of High Street I used to consider very southern because of its handsome buildings, prettily coloured stone, affluent air, lots of space and flashes of greenery, as opposed to the meaner, narrower, darker high streets of the north. I suppose it counts as the Cotswolds, though I'm not sure where the Cotswolds begin and end, or if it's just a state of mind, not geography. Naturally, I went first to look for the charity shops. All this affluence was bound to conceal some unconsidered treasures. They seemed a bit cleaner than the normal run, but disappointing, full of the usual modern tat, plastic toys, cheap clothes. Anything old, that is earlier than the 1980s, seems to have disappeared completely from all charity shops. Flown to eBay, perhaps? I don't think I've actually bought anything in a charity shop for about 3 years, though I live in Hope, and they're always my first points of call in any strange town. I spotted an Oxfam bookshop, one of those dedicated ones that have become more popular in recent years, though their prices are not all that remarkable, considering they get their books for free and don't pay their staff or council tax. Real second-hand bookshops hate them, of course, as they compete unfairly for the same market. This, too, turned out to be disappointing. No old books at all, just cheap, modernish rubbish. Clean and tidy, but characterless. Nothing like the wonderfully crammed, untidy, atmospheric little treasure trove, which is my local Oxfam bookshop in scruffy old Kentish town. Opposite the Church and the Green, I came upon a real second-hand bookshop, Church Green Books, which was open, surprisingly, it being a Monday. I asked for Lakeland Books, as I always do, especially when I'm far from Lakeland, as you can often buy first editions of Wainwright that have been lounging at the back of their shelves for decades. They did have two volumes of a 1777 guide to Westmoreland and Cumberland, but I couldn't find the price. I asked the lady assistant, busy-looking but doing nothing in particular at the front desk. She couldn't see the price either. She said the boss was not here. She could ring him on his mobile but didn't want to disturb him again. Oh no, poor thing. How awful to be rung up by people wanting to give you money. But eventually she did agree to ring him. The price was £275, so she reported back, but he could drop it to £250. I said I'd think about it. Still am. But I did buy a little 1920s booklet on Coniston, price £5, so I hadn't totally wasted her time. Poking round the shop, I came across two special sections, one on bell ringing, another on Morris dancing. "It's what we are known for," said the woman rather proudly. How wonderful, I thought, to have so many books on such esoteric subjects. Is there any subject which is not being collected by somebody? I do hope not. We are now in an age of niches. The smallest specialist magazine, shop, dealer, blogger, tweeter, twitterer, if they can somehow raise a small flag, put themselves on the map, can let their existence be known to others of a like mind out there in the big wide world. I was in Whitney looking for one particular niche, teddy bears. And there it was on the High Street at number 99, Teddy Bears of Whitney, known to teddy bear lovers all over the world, a mecca for worshippers to come to and gaze longingly and dewy-eyed at their priceless collection of famous and historic teddy bears. I'd started at the wrong end of the High Street, so had to work back to the other end, the quieter north end of the town. It's in a twee, sweet-looking, double-fronted Beatrix Potter drawing of a building. Primarily, it is a shop, dating back to the 17th century, selling teddy bears in order to survive. But the most important and most interesting part of the premises is a museum, containing over 150 old teddy bears, which you can look at for free, for there is no admission charge to the museum part. How did they come to be here? In Whitney. Something to do with blankets? Were the earliest teddies made of wool, perhaps? Or is it simply because the creator, the collector of the teddy bears, happened to have been born and brought up here in Whitney? Neither theory turned out to be correct. The owner and creator is Ian Pout, a rather distinguished-looking gentleman of about 60, a little plummy, definitely officer class, who could easily be running a high-class Chelsea antique shop, used to putting cheapskates in their place. The sort who poke around his premises for ages, ask the prices of his best bits, then spend only £5 on a cheap booklet. He led me through the shop part, past rows and rows of simpering, ever-so-appealing teddies. There are over 1,000 different ones in all in the main shop, which extends into a long back addition, unseen from the street. We went upstairs to his little office, crammed with packages, books and files. He had to clear a space before we could both sit down at the same time. Pout, that's an unusual surname, never come across it before. He said it was a corruption of Dupont. Some Duponts had come across from France during the Huguenot times, but didn't get much further than Dover, which is why today you find most Pouts, if you find any at all, still living in Kent. He was educated in Kent at King's School, Canterbury, the son of an accountant who worked for BOAC. Ian left school at 18 and went into the city to train as a stockbroker. It seemed exhilarating and as good a way of earning a living as any. There was a stockbroker in our road who was conspicuously well-heeled. Maybe he gave me the impetus, I can't remember, but joined the stock exchange I did and became what was known as a blue button, the lowest form of life allowed on the old stock market floor. I was really just a clerk learning the trade. I loved the buzz, but always saw it as a way of building up some money prior to doing something else I really wanted to do on my own, my fantasy being to move to the country and open my own antique shop. There was a financial slump in 1973-4, I was only 28 and hadn't made a lot of money, but had no family commitments, so decided to make the break then. I opened a small antique shop in Charlbury, not too far from here. It is an attractive village close to Woodstock and Burford, so drew quite a few tourists. I sold country furniture, nothing too specialised, and soon became a dealer's dealer. I did a brisk trade, with small profits but a high turnover, selling mainly to other dealers. Business went quite well. I married, and by 1981, with our second child on the way, I began to think I needed a more secure income, not dependent on travelling hundreds of miles every week scouring the country for stock. I had expanded to a second shop here in Witney, where we had a lot of space. I decided to devote some of this to selling Crabtree and Evelyn products, then not as widely available as they are now, and stylish stationery. It was a steady enough business, but little that we sold cost more than £5, and we could not sell enough to make a living on that alone. We began to sell a few soft toys, and, with vintage toys and teddy bears also being for sale with the antiques, the beginnings of a new niche business dawned on me. It was in 1985 that he decided to clear the stationery and toiletries and concentrate instead on just one item, teddy bears. He could, in theory, have gone for any number of other items. Like a good many of the other museum creators and curators I had met so far, he had not been before then a passionate collector of the subject that was to dominate his life. He freely admits it was a calculated business decision. He needed to make a living. Selling teddies to collectors was an original concept, which he felt would be interesting, unusual, fun, and hopefully profitable. It was a time when lots of niche shops and businesses were setting up, Tie Rack, Body Shop, and many others. Selling something specific seemed to be a good way to draw people to the workaday town where I was, as long as we made the right choice of what to specialise in. I had some experience of selling teddy bears in the shop and knew that one or two such specialist shops had been established for a few years in the USA. My family and friends, not unreasonably, thought I had gone mental. From the beginning, he saw his shop and museum as being aimed at adult teddy bear lovers and collectors, not at the children's toy market. He knew of the famous firm of Steiff, the world's leading manufacturer of teddy bears, and approached them with a view to stocking their replicas of classic teddy bears. As an antique dealer, he knew about buying at auctions and fairs and from other dealers. So he set out to source as many old teddy bears as he could. His main aim was to resell them in his store, but from the beginning he found he couldn't part with some he really liked, so found himself keeping these for display in the shop, eventually giving over one room to create his own teddy bear museum. I had assumed, without ever really thinking about it, that teddy bears have always been with us, since children first had cuddly toys back in the, not sure which century, but surely a long time ago, possibly medieval? Rag dolls are, in fact, pretty ancient, handmade long before any were manufactured, while images of animals such as bears had appeared in children's books and had been used in toys and games, such as Skittles, since the early 19th century. But the cuddly, soft toys we know today as teddy bears are a relatively modern invention, scarcely more than 100 years old. Both the Americans and the Germans have claims to have first thought of them, but Ian prefers the German version and believes it was the Steiff company that first manufactured them in 1902. Margareta Steiff had founded her eponymous soft toy firm in Giengen in southern Germany in 1880. Her nephew, Richard Steiff, was the company's chief designer and thought that boys should have a masculine equivalent of a girl's doll. Like a doll, it should be jointed, i.e. the head, arms and legs should move. The two animals he thought would be best to model the toys on were an ape and a bear. Using drawings he had made of these animals at Stuttgart Zoo when he was an art student, he made samples from mohair. His aunt, Margareta, thought that this material would be too expensive as the company had become famous for products made of felt, which was cheaper. Richard persisted, believing that mohair would be more durable and sympathetic to the character of the animals. He took samples of his two new toys to the Leipzig Toy Fair in February 1903. He displayed them on his stall, but failed to get any orders. He was packing them up and about to leave the hall when an American buyer, arriving late, stopped and asked him if he had any new toys. He showed him the ape and the bear. The buyer immediately said the bear was just the novelty he was looking for, and there and then ordered 3,000. They did so well, he soon increased the order to 12,000. They were made in the Steiff factory in Germany and dispatched in crates to the USA. While the American Ideal Novelty and Toy Company also has a claim to have made the world's first jointed teddy bear, Ian has studied the factory records and believes the claim by Steiff in Germany is better documented. The rival story involves the American President Theodore Roosevelt. In October 1902, he had gone south to settle a border dispute between two states, Mississippi and Louisiana. After various political meetings, his hosts took him out hunting, as they knew Roosevelt was a keen game hunter. They promised him bears, but after several days hunting they found none, except a baby cub, which they captured and tied to a post. They invited the president to take a pop at him. The story goes that President Roosevelt refused, saying he could never look his sons in the eye if he shot a tethered bear cub. This incident made all the American papers next day, and Clifford Berryman, an illustrator for the Washington Post, drew a cartoon of Roosevelt refusing to shoot the cub, with the caption, "Drawing the line in Mississippi," thus bringing the two stories together with one headline, as all good cartoonists try to do. Very smart. In New York, Morris Michtum, the owner of a Brooklyn shop selling novelties and candies, decided to get his wife to do some quick needlework and create a soft toy based on the cartoon bear. She did so, and he put it in his shop window, calling it Teddy's Bear, Theodore Roosevelt being universally known as Teddy. He wrote to the president asking permission to use his name, and the president is reputed to have written back saying that it was fine, that he had no objection, but did not know what good his name would do in the toy bear cub business. This actual letter has been lost, although Ian believes it did exist. The New York shop owner may therefore have inspired the name Teddy Bear for that particular sort of toy bear. A year later, he started manufacturing them, setting up the Ideal Novelty and Toy Company. Ian, however, is convinced that the Steiff Company was the first to produce them, if only by a few months. Either way, it seems that teddy bears were created at around the same time, independently on each side of the Atlantic. The success of the teddy bear was immediate, with the craze particularly strong in the USA. Society women carried them around, lovers gave them to each other on Valentine's Day, popular songs were written about them, and hundreds of different manufacturers in the USA, Germany and later England started making them. The Steiff Company still makes a wide range of teddy bears and other soft toys for both collectors and children. Steiff teddy bears are still the most coveted, particularly by collectors of old bears. So when he began his museum, Ian sought to collect the rarest Steiffs he could afford. In 1989, he received a postcard from Christie's in South Kensington. This showed a photograph of a red teddy bear in a Cossack outfit on the front, and on the back, a teasing riddle which read, "When is a red teddy bear white?" The answer, written upside down, was, "When it belonged to a Russian princess." This drew his attention to an upcoming sale of vintage dolls containing this old Steiff teddy bear called Alfonso. When the catalogue arrived a few weeks later, Ian was pleased to see that the cover featured a 17th century doll and not the red bear he coveted. Inside, a brief description said the bear dated from between 1906 and 1909 and had once belonged to a Russian princess, given to her by her father, the Grand Duke of Russia. It was the first red Steiff bear ever seen at auction, and his Cossack costume added to his aura. I could see that he was in what we called loved condition, i.e. worn, but I was immediately smitten by him. He had it all, rarity, provenance, and an extraordinary magnetism. I just had to have him. He would be the ideal star for our museum, and I felt his association with Imperial Russia would be something teddy bear collectors around the world would want to share. The estimate was £2,000 to £3,000. Ian set off by car early on the morning of the sale on the 18th of May, 1989. Over breakfast in a hotel near the South Kensington sale room, he opened that morning's Independent newspaper to find the teddy bear looking at him. He subsequently discovered Alfonso had also been featured on breakfast TV that day. By the time he got to Christie's to have his first look at the teddy in the fur, the estimate had jumped to 6,000. He had hoped that only a few teddy bear collectors would attend the sale, as there were only 15 teddy bears compared with over 100 dolls in it. The bears were not due to be auctioned until the afternoon, so Ian went off to the West End. I was so excited and preoccupied by thoughts of Alfonso that I returned to find I had left all my shopping in the taxi. There were, in fact, only 15 or so people in the room when the teddy bears came up, but bidding quickly jumped to 6,000. After that, there seemed to be just one other bidder, whom Ian didn't recognise. They fought it out, with Ian eventually winning, paying £12,100 to secure Alfonso. This broke the world record for a teddy bear, the previous record being 8,800. His purchase received worldwide press attention, but with it came rumours that he might have been done, that the teddy bear was a fraud. Christie's had not revealed who had sold the bear. So Ian wrote a letter to the vendor, care of Christie's, asking them to forward it. For months he heard nothing. The silence was puzzling, but fortunately, within a week of the sale, I received a visit from Jörg Junginger, the head of Steiff's design department. He knew about the sale, but had never seen Alfonso and could find no record of him in their archives. He had heard the rumours as well. But the moment he saw Alfonso, he confirmed that he was undoubtedly a Steiff from around 1908. He even found a thread in his left ear, a tiny remnant of a cotton label, which would once have been attached under the button in his left ear. Since 1904, all Steiff teddy bears have had this mark. So I was happily reassured. Then, out of the blue, 6 months after I had written my letter, I got a reply from the USA from a Mrs. Nancy Leeds Wincoop. She confirmed that it was she who had sold Alfonso, and that he had belonged to her mother, the original owner, Princess Xenia. Her father, the Grand Duke of Russia, a first cousin of the Tsar, had given him to her in 1908 when she was 5 years old. She christened him Alfonso, and it was her English nanny, Miss Ball, who made his Cossack costume, turning him into a truly Russian teddy bear. Princess Xenia loved Alfonso and took him everywhere with her. In 1914, he accompanied her for a holiday in London, staying in Buckingham Palace with her mother, who was a cousin of King George V. War broke out during their stay, and so they were unable to get back to Russia till it was over. Then the Russian Revolution came, and the Romanov family were executed. Her father was one of those who were killed. She eventually ended up in exile in the USA, still with Alfonso. He was the only present she always kept with her until her death, as he had been given to her by her beloved father. Her daughter, Mrs. Nancy Wincoop, had inherited him, but in 1988 decided to sell him. She took Alfonso to Christie's in New York to be valued. They suggested that he should be sold in their London sale room, as this was where their specialist toy sales were held, and, with a teddy bear expert there, he would fetch a better price. As for why he's red, no one is quite sure of the reason, although red was a fashionable colour in Russian society at that time. Ian thinks only a limited number were made, perhaps as samples, and that the Duke may have bought him from Harrods in London on one of his visits. We think of red as the colour of the Russian Revolution, but I was in St. Petersburg recently and learned that red has always been a distinctive and much-loved colour in Russia, long before the revolution. It signifies beauty. After Alfonso was purchased, Ian took him on his own world tour, visiting the USA, Japan, Monaco, Germany, and other countries, starring at teddy bear conventions and gatherings. Mostly, he now lives at home in Whitney, safely inside a bulletproof glass case above the reception desk. Getting him through customs and security these days is much harder than it used to be. Ian admits his business has benefited greatly from Alfonso in attracting customers and collectors, which was part of the object. He's also made quite a bit of money on the back of Alfonso. Steiff in Germany agreed to manufacture 5,000 exact models of Alfonso, which Ian sold for £150 each. All of them were sold by 1993. Now, the replicas are collector's items in themselves, as no more will be made, though he has for sale replicas of other well-known teddy bears by Steiff and other manufacturers. Ian has gone on since to pay other big prices to secure choice teddies for his museum. In 1990, he sent his wife Jane along to a Phillips sale to bid for a black Steiff bear, deciding that if he was seen to be there, the price might go up. She bought Othello for £8,800. The most he has paid so far is £55,000 in 1995 for Aloysius, the teddy that appeared in the Granada TV adaptation of Brideshead Revisited. After the series, which took 21 months to film, had finished, the producer, Derek Granger, said that Aloysius had been an exemplary actor. He was never late, never bumped into other actors, and was never drunk. He continued to work while he was quite ill. He once bled a little straw and had to be rushed for treatment. Not the first time that an actor has come apart at the seams. Aloysius was a very old American bear which had been loaned to Granada by Peter Bull, the actor and famous collector of teddy bears. It had been returned to him after the filming. On Peter Bull's death, his partner sold Aloysius to an American couple, the Volps, who were at the time the world's greatest private collectors of teddy bears. In 1995, they were downsizing and offered it first to Ian.
"I did have to pay a lot for him, considering he had seen better days and suffered from a lot of loving, but I wanted Aloysius to come back to England, where he had earned his fame. I was willing to pay what they wanted."
In 1994, the world record was smashed when a Japanese businessman paid £110,000 at Christie's for a teddy bear. Like Ian, the businessman was planning to make this bear the centerpiece of his soon-to-be-opened teddy bear museum in Japan. This particular bear had a good story, as it had been owned by Colonel Bob Henderson, who, as an officer in the Royal Scots, had carried his bear into battle in his uniform pocket. Many photographs exist showing him at the front with the bear. Colonel Bob, who died in 1990, went on to become a leading light in teddy bear collecting and did a lot of work for charity. His daughter had once dressed the bear in girl's clothes, and Teddy Boy became Teddy Girl. The all-time record price for a teddy bear has since been broken yet again. It currently stands at £135,000. For a teddy sold in a Christie's charity auction of 20 one-off customized teddies made by leading design firms and couture houses, the record breaker had been customized by Louis Vuitton and was bought by the owner of a Korean museum.
"I've not seen his museum, but know that it has a fine collection of modern bears. The price was a result of a lot of publicity plus the important charity element. I don't expect another teddy bear to reach that price again in the near future."
While we were talking, Jan, one of his five staff, had been popping into his office from time to time to say that someone had arrived with a teddy for him to see. Most times he gave a sigh, for, in his experience, most people imagine their bears to be older and worth more than they usually are. He went down on one occasion to see a lady who had arrived with two teddies.
"I don't really want them," he said on his return, "but I've offered her £50. They're not interesting enough for the museum, but I might get £75 for them from a collector, if I'm lucky, but they're not worth more. She's turned me down. She says she will only accept £75. So that's it. She's gone.
He picked up a box from the floor, which had arrived by post that morning, and took out a small bear wearing a homemade knitted black woolen jacket and trousers.
"It's from a lady in Scotland. I told her just to send a photo, but she's sent the actual teddy, which is very trusting of her. It's early German, although not by a recognisable maker. I love him, and will offer her £150, which is a fair offer, which I hope she will happily accept. The most I have paid to someone just arriving off the street or contacting me out of the blue has been £5,000. It's age, combined with charm, a certain look in their eyes, that can do it for me, but often what attracts me most is their story. Obviously, if you have a provenance like those of Alfonso or Aloysius, that is extra special, but I'm touched by ordinary people's stories. The other day, a lady donated one to the museum, asking me to take care of it. She had had it throughout the whole of the war, and it kept up her spirits in dark times. She didn't really want to part with it, but she was now very old and had no one to leave it to. It wasn't a very attractive or valuable bear, but my feelings towards it changed when I heard her story.
We then went down to look at the museum. It's in a small side room, to the left as you enter the shop, with the exhibits in glass cases, well presented, clearly and informatively labelled. I duly admired Aloysius, and also Theodore, which had been Peter Bull's personal teddy bear, a very small one, which he carried everywhere with him in his pocket, for which Ian had paid £14,300. One of the special displays is of Winnie the Pooh memorabilia, which he collected at various auctions. Of the many literary teddy bears, Winnie the Pooh, who featured in A.A. Milne's stories, first published in 1926, is almost certainly the most famous. Milne wrote the stories for his son Christopher Robin, to whom he had given a bear on his first birthday. It had been bought at Harrods and was made by the English firm of Farnell. This was known as Edward Bear, as they decided to give it its Sunday best name instead of run-of-the-mill Teddy. In England, Edwards have always been shortened to Teddy. But in the USA, Roosevelt got his nickname from a contraction of Theodore. But became known as Winnie the Pooh. Christopher Milne bought other soft toys at later birthdays, till they had a whole family of animals, including Piglet, Eeyore, and Tigger. The displays have some original 1920s Farnell teddies of the appropriate type, but not Christopher Robin's actual teddy, the one that was the original Winnie the Pooh. That is today in the New York City Library. But the display includes the original Honey Pot, made by Christopher himself and labelled Pooh Bear, and a letter from Christopher Robin, aged 6. There are other letters and telegrams from family and friends, in one of which Piglet is spelled Biglet, which appears to have been an alternative name used in the family. There is also a letter and drawing by Ernest Shepherd, the artist who drew the original illustrations. In this letter, written in 1971, he explains that he based Winnie the Pooh on his own son's teddy bear, who was known as Growler. "When the Second World War came, my son and his wife decided that they should go to Canada for safety. There in Montreal, poor Growler was savaged by a dog and died." Reading the labels as I went round the museum, and the stories attached, it is remarkable how loyal people were to their teddies throughout the whole of their lives. During the First World War, it was quite common for ordinary soldiers, not just sensitive officers, to take little teddy bears with them into the trenches. Special little souvenir teddies, manufactured for this purpose, probably given to them as good luck tokens, which they carried in their pockets. On their deaths, the teddies were returned to their families and kept as family memorabilia. In 1912, after the sinking of the Titanic, Steiff created a limited run of 494 black bears to commemorate the tragedy. Sounds a pretty cynical bit of merchandising, but I suppose no worse than many touching souvenirs that have since been produced on tragic occasions. Today, they are greatly prized and rarely appear on the market. Ian has only one. According to Ian, showing me a copy of an old children's story published many years ago in Canada, the term punk, which became popular in the 1970s for a certain style of pop star and haircut, came from this book. Its hero is called Pumpkinhead Bear. And on the cover, his hair does indeed stick up in that spiky way favoured by Johnny Rotten. That's Ian's story, anyway. However, looking up the word punk, I learned that it was used in the 16th century for a harlot. Later, it referred to a gay boy. Then, in the 1900s, it was used in North America for a worthless youth. I suppose, though, that the sticky-out hair element could well have come from that Canadian children's book about a punky-looking teddy bear. At one time, in the 1920s, novelty teddy bears were very popular, especially those made by a firm called Schuko in Germany. They included bears that contained vanity sets or scent bottles, or teddies holding violins that played when you wound them up, or driving cars. These are now greatly desired by arctophiles, as teddy bear collectors are called, taken from the Greek for lover of bears. At one time, there were several notable teddy bear collectors in Britain, such as Giles Brandreth, who with his wife ran a teddy bear museum in Stratford-upon-Avon, but that is now closed, with Ian having bought some of the choicer items. In recent years, Peter Bull was perhaps the collector best known to the general public. He was born in 1912, son of Sir William Bull, MP, educated at Winchester, and became a successful and much-loved character actor on stage and in films. He died of a heart attack in 1984. In the world of teddy bears, no one has quite taken his place. Ian failed to think of any celeb collectors today. Celebs, of course, always help to put any unusual collecting subject on the map.
Peter Bull was the first person in England to write seriously about teddy bears. His books were bestsellers and he acquired a huge following. Now that he and Colonel Bob, another huge character, have gone, we haven't got anyone at the moment in England whom the general public associates with teddy bears. A shame, but maybe one will come along soon.
Ian has no idea how many collectors there are in Britain or in the world at large, but he says these days they are pretty equally divided between men and women. This surprised me. Until about 30 years ago, most collectors were women. He thinks the subsequent rise in prices, with world records being smashed at auctions by people like himself, brought in many men who bought with a view to investment. In Britain alone, Ian reckons there are now more than 50 dealers who sell old teddies. Prices have remained very high for top quality, but second 11 examples have gone down in value. Although some manufacturers and shops have clubs, there is no generic teddy bear society, which I found surprising, as most collectors, however esoteric their passion, usually manage to join together in a club, have meetings, issue a magazine, elect officials, before they all fall out. However, there are lots of teddy bear conventions and exhibitions held at regular intervals around the world. Each year, Ian has a big teddy bear event in Whitney, hiring a local hall, as his museum and shop could not cope with the crowds. This normally attracts around 400 teddy bear collectors. In 2008, to celebrate the 100th birthday of Alfonso, over 500 fans turned up for the 2 days of celebrations. His museum and shop, so he says, is still primarily a business, not simply a labour of love or a self-imposed duty, as it is with many people who have created their own museums. In a way, his interest is academic rather than a mad obsession. Ian is highly knowledgeable, but yet he is still devoted to his teddies. So what will happen to them in the future? His three children, now all grown up, are building careers in other fields.
Naturally, I would like it all to stay together as a going concern, with the museum kept open and available to anyone who wants to visit. Teddy bears have an uncanny ability to make people smile. They've had a place in the childhoods of millions of people all over the world for over 100 years. But I don't know what will happen to my collection. At the moment, though, I have no intention of retiring. There is one famous bear I would still love to own. But which one is something I prefer to keep to myself? I tried to guess, suggesting the original Teddy's Bear, the one the New York shopkeeper made in honor of Teddy Roosevelt and stuck in his window. Too late, he said. That no longer exists, although a replica is now in the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, which shows how seriously some countries do take their teddy bear history. In that case, what about some of our famous British bears, such as Rupert Bear? I used to read about him in the Daily Express when I was a boy, and his stories go back to the 1920s. Or what about Paddington Bear or Sooty? Originals of them presumably exist. Perhaps something to do with the Teddy Bear's Picnic, the song made famous in the 1930s by the Henry Hall Orchestra? Ian refused to be drawn. But I do hope he eventually acquires it, whichever elusive teddy bear it is he is so keen to get his hands on one day, and that his museum continues to grow and expand. There are lots of museums that contain toys and games, dolls and teddies, showing us how they are part of our heritage, of our life and cultural history. But very few that restrict themselves just to one particular toy. Or is it a doll? I still wasn't sure. Anyway, I learned a great deal I didn't know about teddies, but perhaps not much about museums. It is an unusual situation, with a museum as part of a shop, and each clearly helps the other. But it is not the sort of thing I would envisage running. My wife would go bonkers if I came home and said I was opening a shop as well as a museum. But I came away inspired to keep an eye out for old teddies. Trouble is, I'm already looking out for old wirelesses, ancient pencil sets, baked bean advertisements, lawnmowers, Laurel and Hardy memorabilia, and even Northumbrian bagpipes. Over and above all the stuff I'd been collecting before I started on my travels, I'm not sure how I will cope. Unless, of course, I do open my own museum. Teddy Bears of Whitney, 99 High Street, Whitney, Oxfordshire, OX28 6HY. Telephone 01993 706616. www.teddybears.co.uk. Chapter 16. The Kelvedon Hatch Secret Nuclear Bunker, Essex. I was beginning to wonder if I had made a mistake, or misunderstood the words, written them down wrongly. Perhaps it was bunker as in golf. And I hate golf, wouldn't want to visit a museum devoted to golf. Or should it be banker, not bunker? I'd done a money museum, so I didn't want another museum on a similar topic. I do have rules. The whole idea of a secret bunker did sound bizarre and unlikely, especially in such an ordinary, nondescript, featureless stretch of rural landscape deep in the heart of Essex, the rolling, changeless countryside bit, not the suburban chunks where the chavs are supposed to live. I'd got out at the end of the line, at Epping Station, and then went to look for a taxi. I asked the driver how much to the secret bunker, and he said £20, which sounded reasonable enough, as on the map it looked about 10 miles away, but didn't seem to be near anywhere, and I knew I would never find it on my own. Anyway, I hate driving. Done more than enough of it this last year. As we left Epping, the driver told me that Rod Stewart lived not far away, and also Aaron Lennon, the footballer, and I said, "How fascinating." Then, once out in the country, he insisted on stopping at a place called Greenstead, outside what he said was the oldest wooden church in England. "I suppose that means it must be the oldest in the world," he added, as an afterthought. "Possibly so," I replied. He asked if I'd like to go in, look at the spy holes in the wooden tower where the lepers were forced to sit and watch services. He'd wait for me, no extra charge. I said,
How kind, but really I had to get on. I'd only come for one thing, the secret bunker.
It is 13th century, he said.
Another time, I said.
Fortunately, he did know where he was going, as he'd once taken a German film crew there. We wound in and out, through country lanes, quiet villages, then on to a mainish-looking road between Chipping Ongar and Brentwood, near a place called Kelvedon Hatch, where a signpost with a red arrow informed the world, Secret Nuclear Bunker. Obviously it's not secret anymore, or the arrow would not have been there, but I would still not have found it without the helpful driver. We turned off the road, down a little lane, worked our way round several fields where stuff was growing, wheat by the look of it, and came to, well, nowhere in particular. The driver let me out and said, "Walk through that wood." I followed various signs, convinced I was lost, as there was no one else around, till I could see what looked like a 1950s bungalow. I went inside and came to an iron grill, and behind it, a counter, and various notices and warnings such as Decontamination Unit, Dirty Area. Ahead of me stretched a long, menacing tunnel, for at least 120 yards, then it seemed to bend and disappear. Was this the entrance? Or a trap? Or was I in totally the wrong place? I walked gingerly along it till I came to a steel-caged door, then came back to what I had taken to be the entrance. There was still no sign of life. Had the bomb gone off, and humanity done a runner? From my huge experience of museums, the first thing you always come to is someone taking money. The second thing is the museum shop, which is also there to take your money, usually manned by the same person. I always think it's a bit of a liberty, trying to sell you souvenirs of your visit when you haven't done any bleeding visiting yet. The exit to most museums is also where you came in, so they aim to catch you twice. This bunker was proving a right puzzler. Nothing seemed to be obvious. There was a sort of counter and grill at the entrance, so perhaps there were people crouching, watching me on hidden monitors. Yet it felt abandoned, with dusty files and tatty notices, and back along the tunnel I could see a couple of ancient 1950s bikes parked against the wall. I then realized that behind the counter were neat rows of what looked like large red mobile phones. There was an instruction I had missed, saying, "Please take one as you enter, and make sure to leave it behind when you go." These were described as wands, these red things. You had to hold one against your ear and then press various buttons. It turned out to be a most ingenious audio system. As I progressed down the tunnel, I pressed appropriate buttons and could then hear a very informative and amusing commentary explaining everything as I went along. All the same, it did still feel very eerie and confusing as I made my way down the long tunnel. I could hear echoes, bleeps, and far-off messages, instructions and warnings in the distance, round corners and in rooms ahead. I wasn't frightened, as the commentator's voice was comforting, but it was still very spooky. I felt displaced and vulnerable, yet presumably the point of a bunker is to make you safe. I went round bends and eventually came to another set of massive blast gates. Once through them I appeared to have come to the heart of the bunker, a three-story underground building with staircases rising up above my head. I'd expected, having come in on the flat, that I would have to go down into the bunker. But it was all above my head. The tunnel had already taken me 100 feet below the earth, for the bunker had been cunningly built into a hill. This long tunnel, so the commentary informed me, served to keep the bunker secret and to reduce the effects of any nuclear blast. It would also have been a good place to pick off any locals, daring or stupid enough to have ventured inside. They would have been slaughtered once they got into the tunnel, as the bunker was not for the likes of them. It was for the likes of our Prime Minister and Cabinet members, military and civil defence leaders, who would take refuge inside at the first warning of a nuclear attack, or so they hoped. Bolt holes for the privileged, so the cynical would assert, or
a secret centre from whence our leaders would continue to run the country, according to the official line. When fully operational, this particular bunker would have accommodated 600 fortunate people, the great and the good, along with experts and boffins and support staff. As it's just 25 miles from central London as the crow flies, and the nearest of its size and amenities to Downing Street and Whitehall, it would have probably been the chosen bunker for our dear leader in the event of a nuclear explosion. A nuclear bomb never did land on Britain, at least not up to the time of writing, but for almost four decades there was a real threat. A bomb seemed imminent. Any responsible government had to take measures, and so this monster bunker, about the biggest ever built in Britain, was kept on full alert for nearly 40 years, and of course, in total secrecy. It was all to do with the Cold War of the early 50s. It came after the real war against the Germans, and the strong possibility that our new enemies, the Russians, would send over a nuclear bomb. A nuclear bomb had been exploded at Hiroshima in 1945 by the Americans. Then in 1952 they exploded a hydrogen bomb in the Pacific, just testing, just flexing their muscles. Stalin had ordered his top scientists to catch up, and they had their own hydrogen bomb by 1953. The danger, everyone agreed, on both sides was real and deadly. In 1952, when this monster bunker was built, there were hundreds, if not thousands, of smaller versions going up, or should I say, down, all over Britain. Every county council had one, every local borough, even parish councils, even if it was just one large room a few feet under the earth where the local bigwigs would retreat once the early warning sirens had sounded. An organisation called the Royal Observer Corps had their own chain of small, three-person bunkers in which they would hunker down with emergency supplies and send secret signals to their HQ and the other ROC bunkers. In all, there were probably about 20,000 people, councillors, builders, boffins, ROC members, who knew where at least one bunker was. So they were never exactly dead secret. It's hard to believe that the local population here in rural Essex, or in downtown Chipping Ongar, did not suspect something was up. Over 40,000 tons of concrete were poured into the hole inside this hill. Lorries going back and forth, 24 hours a day for 7 months. Tanks containing 24,000 gallons of water was stored. Some 35,000 square feet of living and working space was created underground, with 40-odd rooms in the three-storey building. Surely to goodness there were people who said, "Cor blimey, stone the crows, something going on here, or do I need my eyes testing?" The official explanation, that it was a water reservoir, appears to have been accepted. For the first few years, the bunker was run by the Air Ministry as part of their early warning systems. Then the Home Office took it over directly and it became, in effect, the government bunker. I followed, as instructed, the directions on my wand, going into all the rooms, down endless corridors, and then upstairs and into more rooms, all of them equipped with government notices, desks, tables, files, documents, typewriters, radios, teleprinters, Geiger counters. Now and again I did a double take, seeing secretaries sitting at their desks waiting silently for instructions in their 1950s frocks and hairdos. Blimey, not doing much work, I thought, till I realised they were shop window mannequins. Communications were vital, as it was from here that the government would be in touch with all the other bunkers, big and small, all over the country, and also with the public at large, broadcasting to the nation the final warnings and instructions when the bomb was about to fall. The bunker had its own enormous telephone exchange, a large radio room and a huge plotting room, the sort you see in war films, with a massive map on the floor, counters being moved around, incidents and troops plotted, with the top brass, eyes narrowed, looking grim but brave, watching from a balcony or barking orders. The bunker even has its own radio studio, fully equipped, from where the Prime Minister of the day would have broadcast to the nation. He, or it could have been she, as Mrs. Thatcher was in power while the bunker was still in operation, would doubtless have told us to keep calm and carry on. It is, in fact, a real BBC studio, equipped as it was at the time, and through a glass panel, sitting at a desk with headphones on, broadcasting away at the microphone, I could clearly see Mrs. Thatcher. Only a mock-up, obviously, but pretty scary all the same. Once the final warning had been broadcast to the nation, which they hoped would be 3 days before an actual attack, a government booklet called Protect and Survive would have been issued to every household, telling us to turn off the water, gas and electricity, fill the bath with water, ensure there was enough tinned food to last 14 days, take down the net curtains in case of fire, paint the inside of the windows to reflect away heat flashes, and make sure you had candles, toilet paper, notebooks, pencils and a calendar, then finally take cover under the kitchen table, or in a cellar, or wherever the head of the household had created a safe place, where, of course, you would have instantly died. Well, the vast majority would have done. It was estimated that only 3 to 4 million out of the 50 million of us would have survived the initial blast, and most of those would then have died a slower, lingering death, perhaps taking to the streets in wild hordes, searching for food and water, no doubt furious that our leaders were safely inside their hidden bunkers, scoffing dried food and listening to the BBC. I think I managed to go into most of the 40 or so rooms, but I lost count. It was easily the biggest museum I had visited so far, with easily the most objects, even though most of them were government documents, files and papers. But there are also several thousand bits of technical equipment, big and small, the largest being 2 complete sewage systems. They had to have 2 of everything just in case 1 packed up. No chance of popping out to B&Q, okay, it hadn't been invented then, or to your local hardware store to get another washer, not after the bomb had gone off. The idea was that the 600 people inside would be able to survive for up to 3 months and be totally self-reliant. One of the many weird things about living underground, so I discovered as I wandered around, is that there is no need for heating. Once you get 100 feet or so below ground, it remains at the same temperature, around 60 degrees Fahrenheit, all the year round. This is not because of their 10 feet thick concrete walls, or the iron doors and steel grates, but because the Earth's natural body heat stays constant. It means in a hot summer you come inside and it feels nice and cool, while in a freezing winter it feels warm. However, this was dependent on the bunker being virtually empty. Once you fill it with people, the temperature soars, the air gets a bit fetid, not to say pongy. So, to offset this, they had their own air conditioning system. Energy was provided by diesel oil, thousands of gallons of it stored underground, which would run generators to supply electricity. There was also a fully equipped sickbay and operating theatre, with cardboard coffins lined up, ready for any casualties. I went into the room where the Prime Minister would have stayed. Unlike all the other rooms, it had a carpet, just to show his status, as opposed to polished concrete or lino. Lying in a bed with a grey blanket over him was John Major. I got quite a shock. He had an inane smile on his face, as I suppose you would, finding yourself 100 feet underground. He was the last possible PM who could have used the bunker before it was decommissioned. And he did, in fact, make a secret visit there, as did Mrs. Thatcher. Beside Mr. Major, on the bedside table, just to give it the authentic period touch, was a copy of the Daily Mirror, which had a photo of him on the front and the headline, "Hanging On." I got as near as I could, just to check it was a genuine copy of the Mirror, as I am a collector of old newspapers, and I saw it was dated 10th of April, 1992. The headline referred to the fact that Major had won the general election, but with a reduced majority. I then noticed the byline on the story. The Mirror's then political editor, Alistair Campbell. I made a note to tell him next time I meet him out walking on Hampstead Heath. As I made my way to the canteen, following the signs, I could hear regular announcements coming over the tannoy, giving